I Eat Green with Bhavani Jaraf, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Wednesday. I still can't get used to the fact that here it is 5 o'clock, and in New York, where I am located, it is dark right now. It's still a beautiful Wednesday, but I just am not ready for the long winter. Anyway, I've been busy putting my garden to rest, although this past weekend I actually hosted a new Girl Scout troop. Actually, they're a third-year brownie group, from Brooklyn, who came out and helped plant my garlic. And so that was really nice to meet a whole new group of youngsters who care about the food they're eating and want to learn more. And they're just so open at this young age. And you realize when you work with young people that they are open and that, yes, they have been programmed to, and they have been subjected to commercials and media to buy fast food. But the people they really trust most are their parents, and they still want to do right by them and listen to words of wisdom that come from their parents. And so it was really, really nice to be able to see how much they already knew. So many of them already knew so much about eating well. Not to say that they didn't sometimes partake in food that wasn't good for them, but they knew they were eating something that wasn't good for them, and they were really, really wanted more information and wanted to make better choices. So they helped me get my garlic in, and they look forward to coming back in the spring to harvest some garlic scapes, and then also to come back and harvest the bulbs. So that was really nice. And then, of course, was it Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning, in the middle of the night, I woke up to text messages and emails from my friends down at the Occupied Kitchen saying, help needed, eviction in progress. And I realized, wow, I have this direct line to the people down at Occupy Wall Street, and they were reaching out to ask for help to try to get media attention and get the reporters there and to let people know what was really going on. And it was just, it just felt great to really be connected and to know that they could call upon me and not just me, but I'm sure they have a whole slew of people on their database and email base. And the response has been great. And I think, as unfortunate as the eviction was, I'm hoping that it's really going to fuel the movement. And funny, just yesterday in the mail, I received my new sign to put out front that says we are the 99%. And I'm really so happy to have gotten this sign just in time so that I can be counted as one of the numbers. And I want to suggest that everybody who's listening get in touch with, I got my sign from Democracy Now! I don't know if on the website of Occupy Wall Street, whether you can have a connection to get the poster or not. But this is a plastic sign, the same way, you know, during the elections you see all these signs on the lawn. This is the same type of thing. It's plastic, so it'll hold up during the rain. And especially in my neighborhood, I think it's going to be really great to see some signage and to let people know that there's so many people out there supporting the movement, even if we can't physically be down there. So if you haven't gotten a sign yet, you can go online to democracynow.org and make a small donation and receive a sign that you too can put on your front lawn. And I actually got an email from a friend of mine on the West Coast in Portland who really wanted to put it out there and make a suggestion that we try to encourage the movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement, to use more signage so that we can show how many people are really in support of this left-wing movement. And hopefully, in numbers, we will get some results. And, of course, you still have people saying, you know, well, what's the focus? And as I have said to many people, there is no one focus because there are so many problems that people who are struggling in this economy are dealing with. And so I invite everybody for you to find what your focus is, your individual focus, what issue is most closest to your heart, and get involved. Do something to help turn things around in your own small circle, because it starts at home, and then it goes into your local community, and then the bigger movement. And so, you know, if we all start at home, we can make a personal difference in our own community. Which brings me to what's going on in my home this weekend. I have an annual cooking fest every year, and I look forward to it, and I know so many people at this point look forward to it. So even in those moments when I'm feeling really tired and I think, do I really want to do this? I know that so many people are counting on me to create this event, which takes place the Tuesday before Thanksgiving every year. I've been doing it for about 20 years now. And it's, you know, gone through many incarnations depending on what school my children are in. Seems to be the community I pull from. But since my kids are not in school now, I really rely on my larger extended community, all the people I've met over the years who I consider friends and fellow acquaintances who all want to give back. And we recognize during Thanksgiving how much we have to be thankful for. And in our own way, we can give back by participating in creating a huge, joyful feast for those that are less fortunate. And so we do everything. We make a complete Thanksgiving meal from the turkey and the gravy, which, of course, I don't eat, so it doesn't excite me to be cooking those turkeys, to everything else is vegetarian other than the turkey. And so for the non-turkey eaters, and believe it or not, there are people that are homeless or less fortunate who choose to do the right thing and not eat turkey. So for them, I make this seitan marsala, which is what I will be sharing as my recipe for today. But everything else is vegetarian. So I make the stuffing vegetarian. I make mashed sweet potatoes with orange and pineapple. I make mashed potatoes. We make string bean vinaigrette. We make fresh biscuits. What else do we? Oh, and then we make like 50 pumpkin pies. So anyway, it is a big, big happening, and everybody participates, and it's really quite a scene. And it's a lot of fun. It brings people together, and it's just amazing the joy that comes from people cooking together and working as a community together to create this event. So if any of you are out there who live in the New York area and want to participate, you can send me an email at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And you are listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And they have a new web address. It's prn.fm. Instead of having to type out the whole progressiveradionetwork.org, you can just do prn.fm and go directly to the website and listen to all the archives. So that makes it really easy now. So anyway, there's lots of stuff going on in the upcoming weeks around the Thanksgiving holiday. I wish you all to have a wonderful event. If you are traveling, do it safely. I know I will be with you again next week, the day before Thanksgiving, so we will go over some more Thanksgiving recipes then. But the recipe I wanted to share with you right now is my seitan marsala. But the key to my seitan marsala is actually making my seitan from scratch. You can buy good seitan out there, but most of the seitan comes in little strips or little chunks, and it's hard to really serve up a nice cutlet with the kind of seitan that is readily available. So if you make your own seitan, you can cut the chunks into really nice cutlet-sized pieces and really serve a substantial Thanksgiving alternative to turkey. So this is how to make seitan. You want to start with 4 cups of unbleached white flour, 10 cups of organic whole wheat flour, and the other flour, of course, everything's organic. I cheat a little bit, and I use 2 boxes of the Arrowhead Mills Vital Wheat Gluten. And that just helps with the texture and really makes it good. 1.5 cups of tamari, a 2-inch piece of ginger, and 3 pieces of kombu, which is a seaweed. And helps in the digestion process when you're cooking the seitan, and 9 cups of water. So basically what you're going to do is you're going to mix the flour together along with the wheat gluten, which just looks like a flour when you take it out of the box, and you're going to mix it with the water and just enough to make a dough, and you're going to knead that dough until it gets stiff, about 10 minutes or so. Then you're just going to place it in a bowl and cover it with cold water and let it rest for about 10 minutes. And this recipe, just so you know, it's not difficult to make seitan. It just takes time. You know, there's, you know, many processes to it. So you can do it while doing other things throughout the day, you know, and keep coming back to it and, you know, and leave it simmering while you're going out and about and come back. So anyway, so after you let this dough rest for 10 minutes, you want to bring about 10 cups of water to a boil, and you're going to add the tamari, the ginger, and the kombu to that. So it's 1.5 cups of tamari, the 2-inch piece of ginger, and 3 pieces of kombu to the water. And you're going to put the dough into the water and bring it to a boil and boil it for about 15 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the water before you're adding the broth. I'm sorry. You're just adding the water, the tamari, the ginger, and the kombu, and you're boiling that for 15 minutes. And then you're going to remove that from the heat and allow it to cool. And then with the dough, you're going to immerse that in a bowl of warm water and knead it to remove the starch. And so this is the part that actually takes quite a bit of energy. You're bathing the dough and you're washing the wheat germ out of it so that what will remain is just the gluten. So to do that, you are going to keep running warm water over the dough and knead it in a big bowl. I knead it in a big bowl in the sink. And then I dump the water out, and I fill it up with some clean warm water, and I knead it some more, and then I dump that out. And it takes at least 8 water changes, but I think even more, like 12, till the water is actually coming out clean. Okay, so you're going to just keep, and you can actually see the wheat germ being removed. The other thing is when you're dumping the water out in your sink, make sure you put a strainer, some sort of strainer in your sink to catch the wheat germ, and you're going to have to keep dumping that out. Otherwise, you're going to clog up your sink. So you want to protect your sink with some sort of strainer in the faucet, not in the faucet, in the drain. Okay, so after you've done that, you're going to cut the dough into 4 equal pieces, and you're going to place the dough into some oiled loaf pans and let it rest there. And that will just help it take a shape of like a loaf of bread, and it will fill out the dough pan. Then you're going to bring 10 quarts of water to a boil, and this is just plain water. This is not the water mixture with the tamari and the ginger that you are cooling. This is a new pot of water, 10 quarts of water to a boil. You're going to add the seitan dough to that, and you're going to cook it for about 45 minutes until the seitan starts floating in the water, okay? Almost like you're making huge dumplings. You know how you put dumplings in water, and it, when it's ready, it floats to the top. That's how the seitan works as well. When you first put it in, though, it's going to sink down, so you want to make sure, if you're having the water on a high heat, you want to make sure to get down there with a spatula and make sure it's not sticking to the bottom of the pan. And you're going to cook that for 45 minutes, and then you're going to drain it out. Then you're going to place the seitan in the cooled tamari broth, and you're going to bring that to a boil. And once that boils, you lower the heat and you simmer that for 2 hours. And at this point, you can let that simmer for 2 hours and you can run around, do all your errands and whatever you have to do. And when you come back, you can drain it. And that will be your seitan. And at that point, you can do any kind of serving, you know, into the recipe that you'd like. And so now, once you have your seitan, I'll tell you what to do to make the seitan stew. So, to make the seitan stew, you're going to take you're going to take one of the loaves of the seitan, and you're going to slice it. And you're going to slice it into whatever size cutlet you'd like, but you want it to be about a half an inch thick. Then you can bread it in some breadcrumbs. If you eat egg, you can dip it in egg first, or you can just skip that part and not dip it in the egg. And then with the breadcrumbs, you mix the breadcrumbs with some seasoning, some garlic powder, some basil, salt and pepper. And you're going to fry that up in olive oil the same way you would any type of cutlets. And you're just going to saute it until it's golden brown on all sides. Then in another pan, or you can take that out and clean out that pan, you're going to saute some mushrooms in some olive oil. And when the mushrooms are cooked, you can take those out of the pan. And then you are going to... hold on a second. Hello? Sorry. You're going to saute the mushrooms, take those out of the pan. Then you're going to make a mixture of a roux. And again, if you eat butter, you can use butter, one stick of butter for this. Otherwise, you can use olive oil. And mix in some flour to make that roux. Then you add some Marsala wine, about a half a cup of Marsala wine to 1 cup. Add some tamari, some cloves of garlic, some salt, pepper, thyme, and some poultry seasoning. And that is it. And then that's your Marsala gravy. And you just pour that over the seitan, and it is just delicious. So that is what I serve along with my stuffed pumpkin, which I will give you the recipe for next week. So now I would like to introduce to you my guest today. My guest is author Ellen Jaffe Jones. She wrote this great book called Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. And Ellen is also known as the Veggie Coach. She's a personal trainer and teaches healthy cooking classes that follow diets that are set up by doctors and registered dietitians. And she's going to talk to us about how she encourages people to eat healthy and vegan on $4 a day. Ellen, are you there?
I am.
Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, did you get that recipe?
I was taking copious notes, absolutely.
Good. Yeah, it's a great one. You know, and one of the things that I like to do a lot is, you know, I like all my recipes to be able to be vegan when for most of the time, you know, but some people who aren't vegan can, you know, swap it out. Because one of the things I hear so often from parents is, you know, they cook one way for one person, another way for another person, and they make, you know, one of the reasons they don't like to cook is because they have to make so many separate recipes. And so one of the things that I like to do is adapt all recipes to be vegan or gluten-free or, you know, to accommodate everybody that's going to be around the table.
Right.
So, you know, so I go to the least, the least common denominator, and that's usually how I prepare it.
Yeah, and seitan is just a great thing to make because you can put so many sauces with it, and I have a recipe that I use in my cooking classes, and we make it with a mushroom sauce, and, it, you know, it's just people can't tell the difference. If they, and the whole idea of trying to encourage people to eat a plant-based diet is getting them through some transitional foods like seitan that will often fool their taste buds or their eyes into thinking, yeah, this is like beef stroganoff. Just
right,
like it.
Right. Sometimes people want something a little bit heavier or more substantial feeling than just vegetables. I mean, because that's, I hear that a lot. People are like, well, how do you just eat vegetables? And I assure people I don't just eat vegetables.
Right.
Although I love vegetables and I eat predominantly vegetables, you know, there's so many other foods out there. And so if you don't know what those foods are, you really can't, you're not making the decision from a knowledgeable place, you know, when you're choosing what you're, what kind of diet you're going to be on.
Right.
So what was your aha moment that made you decide to go vegan?
Well, I've had several, and for many people, as I'm sure you experience, it's not a straight, direct line. But the first time was when I was 28 years old, 30 years ago. My sister had just gotten breast cancer for the second time, and I almost died of a colon blockage. I was working as a television investigative reporter in St. Louis, and we had a huge snowstorm, and the station, in their generosity, brought in these cold cuts, and we were trapped there for several days just eating this junk, terrible, high-salt processed food. And I wasn't drinking enough water. So when I was rushed to the hospital, the ER doctors said, you know, they'd never seen a colon blockage that big, and somebody my age and I would need to be on medicine the rest of my life. Well, I ran to the health food store and read all five books on fiber, because that's all there was at the time, and really started changing my diet back then. I morphed more from a macrobiotic diet, which is has been known in the Asian world as a more anti-cancer diet. And the real difference between a macrobiotic diet and a vegan diet is that it includes fish. And it has a number of rules that are pretty restrictive. And, you know, you have to eat foods in your latitude and in season, and it's complicated. So I morphed then at that point to a vegetarian diet, and that really sustained me through having children, and it was challenging doing it with children, and I wasn't completely consistent then. But the second time I changed was when I was a television morning anchor. I had a lot of sinus drainage, and as much as a slice of pizza would just turn on the faucet in the back of my mouth, and I would just be sniffing and coughing on the air. And also I found that my oldest daughter had colic when I was breastfeeding, so I was advised to get rid of the dairy for that, and her colic went away, and none of my other children ever had screaming colic after that once I dumped the dairy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became after I left television 18 years in that, I was a financial consultant at Smith Barney. I was actually the number one market performer in my branch, which was how well I did for clients and not for myself. In fact, I came to believe that it was inversely correlated, which is why I only did that for 5 years. I never made more than $20,000 a year. Didn't get one of those Wall Street bonuses that you hear about, but it did teach me a whole lot about financial planning. And even though I was a consumer reporter in my investigative years, it really solidified how I could crunch the numbers and make this book happen. But during that 5 year period, we were almost held captive in these working lunches where they would serve us pizza, and the only choices we had were what toppings we wanted, or we would go to mutual fund or insurance company dinners that were paid for. Our clients were invited for free, and we just had no choice.
Oh, I was invited to one of those. It was the only time I ever went to a steakhouse.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
where they
were. What am I going to go to a steakhouse for, you know? And
exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
I do eat fish, so I was able to get fish there, but it was just such an interesting place.
Yeah, so that was my life for 5 years. I had my little McDougal soup cups under my desk, but it just wasn't enough. So to make a long story short, I gained 25 pounds, and when we moved to Florida, I was still eating fish and found myself in the emergency room a second time. This time I had hemorrhaging fibroids. They wanted to do a hysterectomy, and I had a smart OB who said, go back to that plant-based diet and call me in the morning. And sure enough, within 3 weeks, all symptoms of menopause, including hot flashes, were gone. And even my husband, who is not vegetarian, was blown away at because he would have his arm around me and he could tell when I was flashing. And I started running at that point too. I actually ran when I was 28 and then put it on hold while I had kids and started again when we moved here to Florida. And now I actually run faster than I did at the age of 28. I coach high school kids in cross country. I often run faster and longer than they do. And another motivating reason was my mom, aunt, and both sisters now had breast cancer. Most of the adults in my family had heart disease, big time, diabetes, osteoporosis, Alzheimer's. I'm the only healthy one at the age of 58. And by the time I had children, my parents were so sick and diseased, they couldn't pick up my children, let alone hold them or babysit them. And I just found, since I waited kind of late to have kids, that I didn't want to be in the same boat. And I really view a plant-based diet as something that is as good an insurance policy as you can ever get in this world. And when you start asking doctors, did you take a nutrition class in medical school, most often the answer is no.
I know. And most of them, you know, if you ask, is there anything I can do, you know, in my diet, most times they say no. Most
right.
times they are not connected to diet as a healing modality.
And I think part of this is changing, but when you start asking questions, and I had a couple of doctors as personal friends, and the pharmaceutical companies bought their education. They bought their clinics. Everything that they have been educated in, at least in my experience, was about give me a pill, give me a procedure, give me a surgery that is going to fix this, as opposed to, yeah, go on that plant-based diet and call me in the morning. As I like to say, and I've said this in my book, Eat Vegan on $4 a Day, I'm the broccoli rep. And when you figure out that there's no money in broccoli, you have to be your own investigative reporter and read the research, read the untainted, unbiased, unpaid for research that doesn't have a particular agenda or vested interest. And, mm-hmm. and sometimes that's challenging to find.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I love about inviting these all my different guests on the show is because we're all coming to the same place. I mean, we recognize that there's no money to be made in promoting us to all eat healthy food. And in a time where so many businesses are going out of business, what is new on every corner is a new pharmacy.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly.
It's a little weird, isn't it?
Where I live in Southwest Florida, I mean, there already was a Walgreens in this strip mall, and they are building one that is three times bigger than the old Walgreens right down the street. I mean, it is mind-boggling. That's the only thing, like, they're building. It's crazy.
Right, well, for us, you know, it seems like they have three on one corner. There's a gas station on one corner and then three pharmacies on another corner at many intersections. It's just amazing. And now
yeah.
with pharmacies bringing in all the packaged foods, people can just, I mean, they're going to just live at the pharmacy. They're not even going to go to the supermarket anymore. We'll just get everything, you know, at the pharmacy, and you know, it's great for the pharmacy because it's going to keep them sick, and they're going to have to keep coming back to the pharmacy.
Exactly, and that's one of the things my book also gets into, is crunching the numbers about how much it costs to be sick, and no matter whether you pay for it, I pay for it, the government or an insurance company pays for our expenses of being sick, it is not sustainable. Preventable disease is not sustainable, and it's just scary when you think about $100,000 is what the price of a bypass is. And when you think about the hamburger on your plate, the $5 burger at the restaurant, if you multiply the number of times you eat burgers over your lifetime and factor in that $1,000 or $100,000 bypass surgery, it's more like a $1,000 burger, depending how many burgers you eat.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, probably a lot less snacks. I think many people eat a lot of burgers.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'm sure, you know, you probably get this, you know, as an athlete, I'm sure people are asking you, you know, do you get enough protein? Because that's something I always hear, protein and calcium, you know, how are you going to get enough?
Right. Number one question, absolutely. And for that question, I have several answers. First of all, yes, I get plenty of protein. I'm also an AFA certified personal trainer as well as a Roadrunners Club of America running coach. So I have the training to understand exactly what I need and what my clients need in terms of percentages and tweaking with numbers so that it's an effective program for them. But the protein for me comes in the form of beans. Now, you can do supplements and some of the bodybuilders do that, but for me, the protein is all in the beans and to some extent the greens. Greens have protein, absorbable protein. You don't have to eat gazillions of batches and bundles of it. I eat a large, usually raw salad at lunch and dinner, and you also get protein from seeds and nuts too, but if you're trying to maintain or lose weight, you probably don't want to overdo those too much. But the interesting thing is if you go either on my website or I have a Facebook page for the book, Eat Vegan on $4 a Day, I have a photo album that's called Races I Have Won on Plants. And when you place in your age group in a running race, usually there's a first, second, and third place award winner, and when they'll take pictures, and when you see these pictures of the three of us standing there, you would think I'm the one who's the meat eater, because I'm the one with a very large and defined, not overly large, but just defined, well-toned muscles and biceps, and usually that's what shows when they take these pictures, and the women standing next to me look like the weaklings, the ones who don't have very well-defined muscles, and in all these cases, they are meat eaters. So another great website is veganbodybuilding.com. When somebody asks the question, where do you get protein, you look at these guys and you just see how amazing they are and their muscle definition too. So a number of athletes are actually using a plant-based diet to enhance their performance. I saw, it's almost like daily I see a story of some big athlete, and I just saw one today, I think out of Texas. I can't remember which team because I don't follow other sports other than running very much. But, you know, they are using a plant-based diet because they understand the proteins and calcium, by the way, are often more bioavailable than meat and dairy, and that's how well our bones absorb it. Just as a quick story, I fell during a race for the first time in 30 years this past weekend over a speed bump at the start of a race that I just didn't see the bump. And I was a bloody mess. They called EMS, and I got up, and I said, you know, I've never not finished a race. I'm going to go finish this race. And people were looking at me like I was crazy. I finished second in my age group. But the point is, I still feel like I should have broken some bones. And I think other people, including a physical therapist who is a friend of mine who ran the race with me, was just amazed that I had not. And I really believe what we need to look at for our bones is not how porous they are, which is what the drugs try and compensate for, but what is our risk of fracture? And I've just seen a number of cases where plant eaters seem to have very little osteoporosis. You know, we consume the most amount of dairy in this country, and yet our osteoporosis rates are some of the highest in the world.
I know. I had bone density, and, you know, and I was so happy. They said, you know, my bones are still like a 30-year-old. So, you know, I must be doing something right also. You know,
absolutely.
I just want to share with everybody, I am not vegan. But I recognize that, and I believe that it's the healthiest. It's just, you know, I still am somewhat attached to some of my dairy and occasional fish. But,
and you know, for so many of us, it's a matter of the visuals that you have. I have the image of my sister going through chemo. I have the image of my best friend dying in front of my eyes, literally, as the chemo ate away her skin. It wasn't the cancer so much. So, you know, when you've seen enough of that in your life, it's just very powerful. And thank goodness that Bill Clinton went vegan about the same time my book came out, because I think that's really helped the sales. But he was trying to avoid a third bypass surgery. And
who was that?
Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
isn't that amazing?
He's just been all over the news in different formats and different programs talking about how eating vegan has saved him from a third bypass. And and saved his life. He was very clear about that on a special that was on CNN called, it was Sanjay Gupta's special called The Last Heart Attack. And actually, my husband watched that and he said, I think after watching this finally, I will no longer say that you're a member of a cult. And, you know, a lot of us do take a bit of grief, but, you know, as the numbers and the research starts coming in on this, it's pretty interesting to see, especially when you look at somebody like me in my family, and I keep saying, if there's anybody out there who wants to study me, boy, I am available. Unfortunately, most of the studies out there, because they're funded by pharmaceutical industry, you have to have already been diagnosed with a disease, and you have to be willing to take medicine for it. So it kind of boots me out of a lot of studies.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things I like about your book so much is the recipes. You know, it's not just telling you how to eat on $4 a day, but you actually include a lot of your recipes. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I have a whole chapter on salads and a whole chapter on salad dressings, because in order to get people to eat more greens and salads, I feel like you have to have a recipe or a salad dressing that is going to sort of, as the Mary Poppins movie went, it makes a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. So, I mean, I love vegetables, and it takes about 3 weeks for our taste buds to change. If you think about ever switching from whole milk to skim milk and how the skim milk looked kind of blue and disgusting and thin, and then after a few weeks, if you ever went back to whole milk, the whole milk seemed creamy and sludgy,
right,
and not as tasty. And it's the same way with getting used to vegetables. So,
and like you said, salad dressing is so important. I have worked in the past trying to encourage schools to introduce salad bars at the schools, you know, or at any type of institution, you know. And when you bring, or even at restaurants where they put out salad bars, but then they put out like a Heinz Russian dressing or
right,
or ranch dressing, and you have just defeated any benefit of eating all those extra raw vegetables if you're going to glob on salad dressing that is, you know, commercially processed.
Right. And I actually have a Caesar dressing in my book that is obviously a little more healthy than what they'd probably be getting in the schools. But some of my dressings are just very easy and simple. My favorite that I use a lot is the creamy tahini dressing, because I like to make hummus from scratch. And so that's really what this recipe is, except that you just add some balsamic vinegar to it to thin it out, and a little bit of soy sauce to give it some sodium and salt, and then you just make it as thin as you want. You can really adjust the texture of it depending on how thick or thin you want your salad dressing. And when I make hummus, it usually stays in the fridge for a fairly long time, so I'm always looking for things to do with the leftovers. So that's one idea. But, you know, in terms of entrees, I like my breakfast. I have a breakfast scramble that actually costs just about 50 cents per serving, and you can put it on a whole grain flour tortilla for another 50 cents. And what's really cool about this is that for people who can't give up their eggs, and people always have these things that they cannot do without, so a lot of the recipes in here are designed to fool your mind's eye so that you don't get bored or you don't get tempted to go back. But the breakfast scramble uses extra firm tofu, just a package of that, and then you cut up a quarter red bell pepper, a green pepper if you can tolerate that, or you can add different color peppers, it doesn't matter, a couple of garlic cloves, a small onion, and some fresh parsley. And when I do this recipe in my cooking classes, I like to call this my magic show, because you take this white tofu and you put all these ingredients in the skillet as you're frying it up, and then you add this wonderful spice called turmeric that is very golden, and it makes the white tofu turn the color of scrambled eggs. And it's just so cool. Everybody goes, ooh, as it starts to turn this color, this golden color, and it looks very beautiful as a finished product. And, you know, you can serve this by itself as a breakfast dish, or you can put it in any kind of corn tortilla or burrito to give yourself a little more caloric input there. Mm-hmm. I also am crazy about some of my desserts, too, just because it's really fun to have a lot of desserts that you can eat and say that, you know, that it's healthy as well. And my favorite probably is the chocolate surprise cake, because I show a picture of this when I do talks around the country of the finished product, which looks like this luscious frosted chocolate cake that you would spend all day making out of a box, even with just this great frosting. And then I ask people to guess what's in it, and they never do. Mm-hmm. And then I go to the next slide, which shows the blender before it's mixed, and you see the zucchini and beets and carrots and applesauce and dates and pineapples. And people just go, wow, you know, you can put all that in a cake. And on my Facebook page, people are always posting when they make it, and they say, you know, just there are no words. Somebody said that yesterday, actually, just there are no words to describe that cake.
Mm-hmm.
So chocolate mousse is another favorite,
now,
too.
It is amazing what's in there.
Yeah.
Date,
yeah.
Pineapple, applesauce, banana, beets, walnuts, carrots, currants, zucchini. Amazing. And then the icing, too. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the icing, of course, is optional, but, you know, it's a cake that's easy to eat the whole thing, but you probably ought not to.
Right.
But if you do, you get a lot of fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And then the chocolate mousse is another great recipe with non-dairy chocolate chips. You just add a cup of that with 1.5 cups of vanilla soy milk and then a package of low-fat or no-fat firm or extra-firm silken tofu. And then you can add maple syrup to this, but most of the cooking classes I've done where I've made this, people find the vanilla soy milk is sweet enough. And then you add a half teaspoon vanilla extract. And you heat the chocolate chips just to the point of almost melting. Put all that in a blender. Pour them up in a little parfait dish, and you serve that to your guests, and they will never know that this chocolate mousse is made without heavy cream.
And I can vouch for that because I have a similar recipe, and I've made it at barbecues and have given it to my son's friends. And that's what I wait to see. You know, I wait to see, you know, and I garnish the top with slices of banana, because I'll put banana in there, too, and call it a chocolate banana mousse pie, and slice up the banana. So, you know, you can't do it ahead of time because, of course, banana turns brown, but you do it right before serving it, and it really just makes it look beautiful.
Right.
And they can't believe it. They can't believe that it's tofu, and it doesn't have to be cooked. Talk about a blender. It's just in the blender and then the refrigerator. It's really wonderful. And the other thing that's really great is that you actually give the cost per serving to the recipes.
Right. And, you know, I tell people when I do this that, or as I've written the book and talked about it, that this was a snapshot in time at the moment the book was published. So your prices may vary, but I still contend that these are the cheapest, healthiest recipes on the planet.
Okay, are you using organic ingredients with these prices?
Well, you know,
no?
I get that question so much. And what I tell people is the book title is not Eat Organically on $4 a Day. But with that said, I have a lot of tips in the book about how to eat vegetables that are and produce that is organic. And the simple way is to go on a website called localharvest.org, and there a map of the United States will pop up, and you will see all these little dots about community sustainable agriculture farms. They're called CSAs, and there are, where I live in Southwest Florida near Bradenton, there are two in our area. In fact, I just came from there this afternoon, where I picked up 4 bags of delicious, almost organic produce. And I say almost because these CSAs and a lot of the local farms don't pay the money it costs to get the organic certification. But if you spend any time there, and I encourage you to do that, especially with kids, so that kids understand that plants don't grow in a shrunk wrap container, it is, you can volunteer and you can participate and see what it is exactly they are doing at the farm. Many of them have organic seeds, you know, the ones that are not genetically altered, and they take great care to get very special seeds that grow as well. But they don't want to pass the certification costs onto the consumer. but many of them are doing what it takes to get the certification if they wanted to. So just spend time there and see what they're doing, ask questions, and that is a great cheap way to get organic produce. But even the studies I have looked at say it is more important to eat conventional produce than to be eating a meat and dairy diet. Why? Because the animals are eating plants that are treated with pesticides and herbicides, and the toxins from these are very concentrated in the animal fat. And it's not only the fat that you cut off from the steak, but there is fat that is also in the muscle, even lean cuts of meat. So if you're trying, if, you know, cancer is something that you're concerned about, it is still important to eat enough vegetables, even if they are conventionally grown. Yeah, great if you can do organics, but again, in terms of eating on a budget, I really focus on what you can come up with at Walmart and the big box stores, because I've spent the last 3 years at Walmart and the big box stores tracking prices, and I'm telling you, those are the folks in the frozen food aisles that, you know, I just want to run up to them and say, hey, there's a great bargain on beans two aisles over. Just follow me. But, of course, I don't do that. But, you know, there's the statistics I've seen are that people who live at the poverty level in this country, it's somewhere between one out of six, one out of seven people. That's about $22,000 a year for a family of four. And I saw so many stories on the news that said you can't eat well on a budget. And even if you don't eat vegan your whole life or even a big chunk of your life, these are still very healthy recipes that if you substitute a few of them a few times a week, you're really going to save. And just a quick example of how much you can save. If you're eating burgers, the cheapest form of hamburger meat at the big box store that I just checked is about 60 cents. And this is 30% fat hamburger meat. You compare that to the biggest bag of beans that you can find at these stores for an equivalent 4-ounce serving, it is a dime. So for one meal, if you replace cheap burger meat with beans, you save 50 cents. Do that over the course of a month, over the course of a year, and your lifetime, you are significantly
saved. And I must say, I mean, beans do take time to cook, and a lot of people don't have the time or the forethought to think ahead of time to soak them and that kind of thing. But even canned beans, you can buy canned beans, and they're still pretty inexpensive.
Right. Canned beans are only twice as expensive as dry beans. But let me just say a word about...
It's still cheaper than the meat.
Pardon?
It's still cheaper than the meat.
Oh, absolutely. A word about preparation. I have a big chunk of my book is devoted to making that easy. And the quick answer to that is a pressure cooker will cook beans in a half or a third the time as cooking it on the stove. But I live in Southwest Florida where we have a large Hispanic population. And when I do cooking classes, I often hear from my Hispanic students that, oh, yeah, you know, I just cook my beans in a crock pot. I let them soak overnight in the crock pot. I drain them the next morning, and I turn it on before I go to work, and when I come home, my beans are done, no big deal. So I have a lot of ideas about how to save time. I was a single working mom at one point in my life, and all I wanted to do was come home at the end of the day and get a healthy meal on the table. So these recipes and the tips in my book are really focused on people like that who don't want to spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. We're going to just take a couple-minute break. I just saw what time it was, and we usually take a break in the middle. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Everyone, you've been listening to Bhavani on I Eat Green, and my guest is Ellen Jaffe Jones, author of Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. And we'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Ellen Jaffe Jones, author of this wonderful book called Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. And we've just been talking about some of the recipes in the book and how the recipes are simple, easy, and she actually gives you the breakdown of the cost, which for so many people is really an issue, because for so many people we hear that it's too expensive to eat healthy. And she's been sharing with us some of her tips on how to do it
cost effectively. Ellen, are you there?
I am.
Great. So why do you think it is that the government doesn't promote more plant-based health and life-giving foods?
Great question. And I have some personal inside information on this. I actually was a media consultant right after I left Smith Barney as a financial consultant. I did that with my husband, who had been doing it for a number of years. We were both former TV investigative reporters from Miami. And we had a client called the National Watermelon Promotion Board. And in my book, I put a chart of how we got paid for this work was through the USDA's checkoff program. And this is about advertising dollars that are allocated to promoting all kinds of food groups. And this is why if you go into your child's cafeteria, you'll see the Got Milk campaign with the mustache.
Mm-hmm.
You might see the beef, it's what's for dinner. Because in my book, I have a chart of how much money dairy products get, $281 million. These were for the last year that I got the statistics. Fluid milk, which is a whole separate category, gets $107 million. Beef is right under that with almost $80 million. And way down at the bottom of the list, very last, is watermelon at $1.6 million. Blueberries are right above that at $1.9 million. So the answer to your question is it's Congress, it's lobbyists, and until you throw the bums out and really make this point that the government should not be in bed with these industries, it's not going to change. If you go into your kid's cafeteria, you're going to open the freezer and you will see stockpiles of hamburger meat that will say on it, you know, courtesy of the USDA. This is surplus that our government is buying up and giving to our kids. And until the priorities change, until it becomes more veggies, and kudos to Michelle Obama for trying to do something about this, but so much more needs to be done. And I just saw a story cross yesterday that Congress is trying to gut the food bill that would actually, it's going to make pizza a vegetable, tomato sauce a vegetable. I mean, it's just, and French fries will be allowed to stay in the kids' food at the school cafeteria.
Well, yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, there's companies like, you hear about Pepsi does a lot of PR to improve their image, and they support, reduced marketing to kids. However, behind the scenes, they're lobbying strongly to prevent a healthy school lunch program. You know, there's all these kind of things that go on that happen behind the scenes that we're not aware of. And
yeah, it's crazy. It really is.
Right. The face that a lot of these multinational companies want to put forward, they know what people want. So they want to put forward this good face. But behind the scene, they're really lobbying hard to keep the unhealthy foods in the schools because that's what makes them money.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating in how you go about changing that system where the whole culture and government is to support these groups, as the book The China Study has eloquently outlined. You know, it's an uphill battle. It really is. And unfortunately, I think what's going to eventually happen is that, you know, I say in my book, we all may be eating vegan whether we want to or not, just because of the way the economy is crashing down. I don't see it recovering. You know, there may be some superficial positive changes along the way, but the gap between the income classes is increasing. And as more people get sick and have personal bankruptcies because they can't afford to take care of themselves, it really is going to be a world out there where it's the survival of the fittest. And who's left standing at the end, I don't know. But, you know, I can tell you from Southwest Florida here, when you go to the beach, it is really a sad, sad story because there you see the sickness, if people can even make it to the beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's, that's what Occupy Wall Street's all about. And, you know, I've been really trying to get more involved in that movement because it just feels right to me.
Well, the interesting thing is with food, you get to vote with your wallet three times a day. And it's sort of hard for people to get their arms around that, but it really is true that you can make a statement and, you know, little by little, things will change. When I was interviewed for a newspaper about 30 years ago when I had come back to St. Louis, and they came to my house and took pictures of the beans and grains on my kitchen counter. And I was so defensive in this article, saying, oh, I don't really mean to be a health food nut, but you know what? I was. And things have changed so much since then. Healthier foods are available. There are many different choices if a person does choose to become a vegetarian or vegan. It is so much easier to do that now. I used to have my bread shipped frozen from a company, French Meadow, in Minnesota.
I know,
Michigan.
And I used to run a food co-op out of my garage when there were no Whole Foods. So I understand. We've been in it probably about the same amount of time together. So, and I raised my kids vegetarian, so I really understand. Before we get off, because I hear... we're just about at that time. Can you share with my listeners how to get in touch with you, your website, your book,
yes,
all that?
Yes. My book is on Amazon. I don't care how you buy it because I'm not in this to make money. I just want to get the word out. But my website is vegcoach.com, vegcoach.com. I'm on Facebook with the book title, Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. So I'm also on Twitter. Either one of those places are great. So whatever
Wonderful.
Works.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. And for everyone out there, eat well, eat healthfully, and have a wonderful rest of the week. And I'll see you next week.